You're listening to Mom Talk, the online community radio show connecting moms across Canada and around the world. Join Helen, Kara, and Tracy, the parenting team from CanadianParents.com, as they talk all things mom. Mom Talk, a podcast for moms, by moms, because we're all in this together.
Hello, I'm Tracy, the host of today's podcast. Today, we're interviewing Julie Ross, who is the author of a new book called How to Hug a Porcupine. Is your 10 to 14-year-old getting an attitude, rolling their eyes, or slamming doors? Here are painless solutions to surviving the prickly tween years. The middle school years can be a minefield for you and your kids. This hands-on communication guide by a qualified tween negotiator shows you exactly how to talk to your kids about peer pressure, raging hormones, mood swings, body image, computer addiction, sibling rivalry, and other prickly issues. Julie's field-tested techniques help you shift from a controlling to a relationship approach, proving that it is possible to hug a porcupine once you know how. Welcome, Julie.
Hi.
What motivated you to write a book about this particular age group?
Oh, I think there's a number of motivating factors for me. One is that in spite of it being such a volatile and often difficult time for parents, it's an age group that I actually really enjoy. And that comes as a surprise to people, especially people who are living through it with their own children. But I enjoyed it in my own kids, and I also enjoy it in terms of working with that age group. And I really feel that it's an age that doesn't have to be as difficult as it sometimes is for parents and their children. Mm-hmm. And I think with, you know, my thought behind the book was, with a little bit of coaching, with a little bit of technique, and really practical skills, that parents could, you know, help their children tone down their attitude and their issues, and it could be a much more enjoyable time for everybody. I also think that basically, parents today need more support than they get. And I think that's parents of all ages, but particularly the middle school years, which I say in the book are often quoted by people as being the worst years of their own life, reflecting back mm-hmm. those middle school years, you know, mm-hmm. which is what we call the tweens now.
What do you think are the basic things a parent needs to keep in mind to arm themselves to handle a porcupine?
Oh, there's quite a few things, even though they're not that difficult to implement. You know, first of all, if we take that image of a porcupine, one of the things to remember is that the answer to the question, how do you hug a porcupine, is very carefully. We want to hug carefully. And that means our approach on everything needs to be a bit on the cautious side. And I don't mean that parents should be tiptoeing around, avoiding their children, feeling anxious at all. But there's basically four qualities that I then apply practical skills to in the book. And these four qualities are ones that I believe parents really need to engender during these years, but also for the years beyond. And the qualities are respect, support, reciprocity, and collaboration. And respect really means understanding what this developmental level is about. And in spite of the fact that my primary metaphor for the pre-adolescent or tween is that of a porcupine, if we think in terms of respect, I like for parents to recognize the developmental stage of pre-adolescence as being actually a metamorphosis, much like a butterfly undergoes, you know, before they become a butterfly. Mm-hmm. So that in the beginning, you know, as parents, we have this caterpillar, and it, you know, it looks like a caterpillar, it acts like a caterpillar, and we get used to it being a caterpillar. Then in the pre-adolescent stage, it begins to spin a protective cocoon around itself, a chrysalis, if you were. And that chrysalis is really similar to the quills of the porcupine. It's a self-defense mechanism, because what's happening inside the chrysalis is that the caterpillar that we knew and loved is becoming butterfly soup. And that butterfly soup is very delicate and very fragile. So they protect themselves with a variety of tactics. Sometimes they become very fresh. Sometimes they begin to experiment with certain things. Sometimes they become very, well, often I would say they become very disorganized around schoolwork and the kind of things. They put up a lot of resistance to their parents, kind of the you can't make me and I don't want to. So, but I see all of those as the chrysalis. And one of the things that we know about the metamorphosis of a butterfly is that if you were to take a chrysalis and shake it frequently, it would disturb what finally comes out, which is this kind of magnificent creature. And the magnificent creature, of course, looks nothing like the creature that parents have raised for the first, you know, 10 or 11 years or 9 to 13 years of that creature's life. It really looks like something amazingly different. So respect means really kind of getting that picture in our minds, recognizing that the chrysalis stage is not a pretty stage, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not a lovable stage. It's necessarily, you know, it's not an easy-to-relate-to stage. It's easier to relate to the caterpillar, and it's easier often to relate to the butterfly, although the butterfly has independent wings, and that's kind of the adolescent period, and that has another whole set of things that go along with it. But once that respect is there, then parents can really begin the second piece of the process, which is to support what's going on developmentally for their child. And one of the things that I liken this to is the other developmental stages that our children go through. So if you recall back to when your child was a toddler, right, mm-hmm. or just before toddlerhood, and they're just learning to walk and they're pulling up on stuff, we support that wholeheartedly. We're like, yes, you can walk. Oh, my gosh, come on, you can do it one step. You know, we're all excited about the developmental process. And the unfortunate thing is that the developmental process of preadolescence often precludes that kind of support because it doesn't look as pretty as walking.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not as pretty, and we're unsure of ourselves and unsure of the whole process.
You're so right. And our children really need our support in that just as much as they needed our support in learning to walk.
Yeah.
So understanding that stage really allows for us to shift into a mindset of how can I support my child.
Yeah, how can I help and how can I accept them?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And from that comes reciprocity, which is recognizing that not only do we have needs as a parent with regards to our children, we have the need to keep them safe, right? Mm-hmm. We have the need to make sure that they get their homework done, that they practice good hygiene and brush their teeth, you know, all of those things that have always kind of been part of the parenting process. But it's also recognizing that they have needs and that they have a need to be independent from us. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the need that's starting to kind of come to light during this period, that they also have a need to separate and prove themselves that they're different, you know, they're different from mom and dad. So, you know, kids often, that some of the rebellion, if you've got a child who's a pre-adolescent and who's rebellious, then, you know, that's coming from a need. Maybe it's not being expressed appropriately, but it's still coming from a need. And once we can identify the fact that there is reciprocity, that the specific need, in fact, that the child may have in a given moment and the specific need that we may have in a given moment, then we can go to collaboration, which is basically saying, look, here's what I need. I know that you need X, Y, and Z. How can we compromise? How can we come to a middle so both of our needs get satisfied?
Very interesting. It makes so much sense. Like, it just really makes sense.
Yeah, but it's hard
to
see.
It's so simple. It's so simple.
You know, that's the whole key. I'm glad you pointed that out because I think if you go into the process of pre-adolescence unprepared, it seems very complex.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not that complex.
No.
In fact, because they're kind of in a chrysalis, it makes it a little bit simpler in many ways. But when you feel as though you're being personally attacked and that, you know, and moreover that the relationship that you built with your child during the elementary school years is suddenly compromised or changing,
mm-hmm.
it can feel very frightening too to a parent.
Yeah. So referring to our tweens as porcupines, do you have anything specific pointers for handling these tweens when their quills are bristling or when they actually become belligerent, if that happens?
Yes. Yes, well, it certainly does. In some of them, you know, just as with any developmental stage, each tween is a very individual type. And, you know, in the book, I really try to cover those types. I try to cover the tween, rather, that becomes withdrawn, you know, the tween that is kind of hesitant to put themselves out in terms of independence in the world versus the tween that's belligerent. In fact, that's, you know, a big chapter in the book, versus a tween that is kind of so out there and energetic and extroverted that you're kind of worried they're going to hurt themselves in some way in being so out there. So I try and cover all of those different personality traits, I would say. But I think the thing that they all have in common is that no matter what personality they have, they all develop quills at this point. And, you know, one very simple tool that parents can use is, and it's so funny because I actually was asked this in a group this morning. You know, one of the parents of a tween said, you know, she's just sniping at me all the time. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, everything I say, it's wrong, and Mom, stop, and, you know, don't talk to me. And she said, it's making me nuts, you know.
Yeah.
So here's a mom who's completely stuck full of quills at this point, and she's wanting to, you know, throttle her porcupine.
Yeah.
And my comment to her was, well, what is she saying stop it, Mom, about? And she proceeded to say what's very common for most parents in this age group, which is that as we transition from elementary to pre-adolescent, we have to learn to stop nagging our children and to really allow them to have a little bit of, for us to have a little bit of a sink or swim policy with them, but that they have to do it themselves. We have to take off the life vest. You don't want them to drown. I think there's no question about that. But some of the nagging that we've been prone to do up until this age has to be dropped because it goes directly against, it's not respectful of their developmental stage and their desire to be more independent because it makes them appear more dependent upon, you know, you as a parent.
Yeah.
So my suggestion is to write it out. Just write it out instead of saying it. So if you notice that there's dirty underwear all over your child's room, you know, and they haven't put it in the hamper, instead of saying, pick up your dirty underwear, get a little post-it note, say, remember to put your underwear in the hamper, stick it to the mirror, and let them go from there. One of the things that that does is it allows us to keep enough of a distance so that they don't, when their quills go out into the, you know, the erect position, that we don't get stuck.
Cool.
Yeah, and it allows them to take it in on their own time. They don't feel as nagged because nagging, again, is not supportive or respectful of this phase.
No. That's good. I think that a lot of parents tend, you know, a lot of parents need that advice.
Mm-hmm.
We don't realize, you know, we think we're doing it for the good of the children, but often we just don't realize what we're doing.
Exactly.
And how irritating that can be. Although it needs to be done, but it can be done in a much nicer way, as you say, by writing notes and giving them a little bit of a life raft to either sink or swim. You know, if you don't put your underwear in the dirty laundry, you know, the stuff's not going to get washed. So someday they're going to wake up and they're not going to have any clean clothes.
You are so right. And I talk about that because I think there is a very real need for consequences at this age, you know, still. And at any age, I mean, up until they go to college, presumably, there is a need for consequences. And we want to work with somewhat more natural consequences. So just as you said, the natural consequence of not putting your dirty underwear in the hamper is that it doesn't get washed. And then you wind up with no underwear one day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they realize how that feels. You know, sometimes they actually have to feel the consequence so that they know that desire comes to them naturally.
That's exactly right.
So that they don't have to rely on their mothers, to, you know,
absolutely,
to remind them.
Yep.
Which leads me to another question about
tweens.
You mentioned before that one of their characteristics is that they're very disorganized. As a mother of three teens, I can relate. Do you have any advice you can offer on how we can get these kids organized? What can we do to help them?
Oh, boy, what a great question. Because as you noted, there is disorganization really seems to be part of this developmental phase.
Mm.
And it's probably partly because of the hormones. It's probably partly because of the changing social situation, you know, romantic interests that just start to kind of percolate at this age and that kind of thing. You know, they become very scattered. So what I tell the parents to do to help with the organizational component, first of all, to work with this idea of reciprocity. So to say to your tween, I need to know that your homework's getting turned in on time. And I know that you're working out your system of organization, right? Whether they are or not, it's okay to give them credit for that for the moment, because it works as kind of a positive expectation. So, you know, what could we do together, and this is where it goes to collaboration, what could we do together that would help you, and then X, Y, and Z, you know, whatever the specific disorganized behavior is. So in the book, I write about two specific cases, one of a boy who whom I call the overwhelmed slacker. And he basically would get homework assignments, and he felt a little overwhelmed with them, so he would just shove them under his bed.
Yeah.
And he would say to his mom, oh, yeah, I did my homework. Oh, yeah, I did my homework. Well, one day she uncovered this, you know, kind of pile of stuff that he hadn't been dealing with. So, you know, it would be very easy at that point to see the disorganization as pure disorganization, when in reality he was feeling overwhelmed. And I think one of the things that are that's helpful in this developmental stage is for parents to come back to feelings. What feeling, what underlying feeling is possibly motivating my child to be disorganized, you know? So mom approached him in this particular case and, you know, and said, I see that maybe you're feeling a little bit overwhelmed because you shoved all your homework under the bed, basically. And in a dialogue that had many, many starts and stops, and that's another thing that I would, you know, urge parents to be aware of, that there are rarely very clean dialogues with a tween. It's much more of a stop and start, pick it up tomorrow, let a couple days go by. You know, I often think of parenting as both technique and timing. So it's choosing the right time to talk to a child about things. So in the stop and start process, one of the things she did was she acknowledged what his strengths were, what his abilities were. And it had nothing to do with homework. She said, for example, in this particular child was a very, very talented basketball player. And so she said to him, you know, wow, I watched the game last night and I thought you did an amazing job. You're such a good team player and you've got so many good skills with that. And she was able to spin that out into a, let's talk about how you might be able to apply those skills to your homework. And what they eventually came up with was a dribble, pass, shoot, three piles, dribble, pass, shoot. And dribble was homework that he needed to, you know, keep up with on a regular basis and kind of had to look at daily. Pass was something that he didn't understand and needed to take back to the teacher. And shoot was homework that he could do immediately.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, so once they had this system, which worked so well for him because of the context of basketball, which he was so passionate about, you know, that improved his organization tremendously. And he never became an A student, but he definitely, you know, brought his grades from C's and D's up into the B range and, you know, is looking at going to, you know, on to college and, you know, with the hope of actually becoming a basketball coach eventually. So sometimes, you know, for the disorganization, what's helpful is instead of focusing on how disorganized your child is, ask what strengths your child has that you can apply so that they can, for themselves, create a link between the disorganization and whatever area they have a strength in.
Yeah.
And, the second child was one who would do his homework, but it was all stuffed in the bottom of his backpack. He never turned it in. So mom was hysterical. She was like, "Are you, what are you, stupid?" You know?
Yeah.
Now that is not what we say.
No.
Just to be clear,
we can think it, but we don't say it.
That's exactly right. Thinking is fine. Saying not so good. But you know, she again did this kind of acknowledging ability, acknowledging what the child's, you know, strengths were, you know, and was able to see that he was very organized, in fact, in getting the homework done. So she said, you know, gosh, you know, I can see how organized you're being with regards to getting your homework done. I mean, it's a lot. You've got math and science and, you know, whatever, Spanish, et cetera. And you really, you know, do it in such a very organized way. And, it, you know, it kind of seems a shame that you're not getting credit for that. And that really turned a switch on, you know, for this kid. And then later he was able to approach her, and in a conversation that kind of went back and forth with the TV on and off and a variety of things, he was able to decide on a system of kind of backpack management, because he didn't have any problem with the management at home. So part of the helping the disorganized child lies in identifying first what is the feeling that's causing the disorganization. Second, what are my child's strengths that I could appeal to, that I could encourage them about, and potentially link to strategies. And then the third is really this, again, going to the broader concept of collaboration, engaging in a brainstorming process so that ultimately the idea, if it doesn't come from the two of you, comes from them. Because one of the big mistakes I think that parents make is giving advice. Mm-hmm. And the more advice we give, the more it rubs
Unless
up against.
Listen.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, the thing is they're developmentally programmed not to listen, mm-hmm. because they're trying to be independent and different. So if they listen to you, then they're the same and they're dependent. Yeah. That advice giving rubs up against their developmental level. And that's why when we give advice or when we frame advice for them, the best thing to do is to frame it in question form. So, for example, to say, well, what do you think would happen if you blank? And when you put it in question form, it doesn't do what I call poking at the cocoon, you know, or shaking the cocoon. It doesn't go against the developmental stuff. It acknowledges
it helps them to think for themselves.
Too. Yes, you're so right. That's exactly right. And that's, of course, one of the things that we want for our children is that they become independent thinkers.
Yeah.
You know?
That's really, really good advice, Julie. A couple of my teens are out of the tween period, and I notice that, you know, as you're saying, we, you know, they don't want to take advice from us.
Yes.
But I've found that I've been able to switch to talking to them more, especially my eldest. I find now he's really coming to me for advice. So he's sort of gone past that period, and he realizes that he is getting some decent advice from me. So you know, he's turned that corner.
Yes.
But I find that one thing I've had to do is switch from talking to him as a parent to talking to him like one adult to another.
That's right.
And, I mean, this is totally different, off topic totally, but it's just sort of saying that, no, when he was younger, he wouldn't take advice until I switched from talking to him as a parent to talking to him as from one adult to another, more on just totally on his level and giving them that respect that that they, you know, that he's earned.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I think what you just said, there's a very important point. Even though he's now an adolescent, or he's older now and not a tween anymore, the tween years are the period of time during which parents need to undergo a metamorphosis as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, talking to the child as a parent versus learning to talk to the child as, you know, with the respect you would afford to an adult.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean being friends with your tween, because, you know, that can be a very inappropriate relationship to try to garner. But it does mean speaking to them in the same way that you would speak to a colleague. You know, what if you were in business with someone who was being disagreeable? How would you speak to them?
Exactly.
And when we make that transition in the pre-adolescent years, it makes the adolescent and beyond years so much easier.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
And I mean, why? You know, it's too bad, because how hard is that? I mean, we love our and care for our children way more than we do any business associates that we have.
Absolutely.
You know, they're so important to us. But yeah, it's sometimes difficult to make that transition. Anyway.
It's really hard. And, you know, in the book, actually, I talk about what I call the paradox of parenting, which is exactly that. We love our children more than anything. Mm. We love them so much that if we were given the choice between losing a limb and losing a child, we wouldn't hesitate.
Absolutely.
Right? We would say, take my arm, take my leg, don't touch my child.
Right.
And despite that, and this is the paradox, there are times when we speak to them in ways we wouldn't speak to a stranger on the street.
Yeah.
And what a shame. Because
they
do deserve the respect and the love that we actually have for them.
Yeah.
They deserve to know that.
They do.
Yeah.
Wow, this is very interesting. Now, something that we always comes up, of course, when, and I'm sure you get this all the time, I'd just like to touch on is sex and drugs.
Oh, yeah.
Are these
love
things,
those.
Yeah, are these things?
I mean, I love the topic.
Clarify.
Yes, exactly.
How, like, we know that they're on the tween's mind. They're subject to it all the time. And how should parents handle sex and drugs?
Well, you know, I think one of the biggest mistakes that parents make is in keeping silent about those topics in the tween years, believing that they won't have to deal with them until their tween becomes an adolescent. And the truth of the matter is that those things, sex and drugs, are really prevalent, much more prevalent today than they used to be in the tween population. And so the topic has to be broached. If the parent has not ever spoken about this before, I'm a big advocate, by the way, in speaking to your child about sex, you know, at the very least, when they're very young.
Yeah.
And then it just becomes part of
the conversation.
It's like factual. It's not anything, you know, crazy.
You're comfortable with it right off the
bat. Yeah. And then, you know, by the time a child's in late elementary school, you want to start talking about, you know, alcohol and tobacco and drugs, harder drugs as well. And so then, you know, so if they haven't done that, if they haven't done any preparation, it's likely that they're going to encounter a very uncomfortable child when they try to broach this subject.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of things that are helpful, and I like to speak in the context of talking about sex because the way in which we talk about drugs is almost identical. One helpful tool for parents in talking about sex is, you know, to sit down and really kind of have a family meeting about it and to present the information in a very factual way.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is when you present it in a factual way, I know one dad did it by bringing in anatomical drawings. You know, just to start, you know, want to make sure we're clear on the body parts. And, of course, the kids are mortified, right? They're just squirming and their heads are down and they're like, oh, I can't believe you're doing this. But it's interesting because in spite of the squirming, it's often easier for tweens to accept uncomfortable information in presentation form. It's almost as if there's a, you know, it gives them a little bit of a distance, so it's not just dad or mom looking them in the eyes.
It's almost like a third party.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it makes it, even though the squirming happens, it's a little bit more comfortable that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, show and tell objects, for example, like a box of condoms is a good idea to bring out. Sometimes parents worry that if they talk that specifically about sex and protection with their children, that it will result in the child experimenting more. But actually, all of the research shows that in places, for example, in countries where the information is institutionalized, in other words, it's taught in schools at a very young level, as young as preschool, those countries have much less teenage pregnancy and far fewer STDs than we do here.
Really?
So there's great evidence to say, talk about it often, talk about it, you know, talk about it at a young age, and if you haven't started, start. So, and over time what happens is, you know, sometimes parents also think of this as the big talk. You know, we're going to sit down, we're going to have the big talk, and then, boop, it's over.
Yeah.
And it's really not. It's a series of small talks. And
good
you want to start with, you know, body parts. You want to, you know, move on to what goes where, and then you want to move on to sexually transmitted diseases and prevention. And so it kind of has a little bit of a building block scope to it, because you don't want to talk about sexually transmitted diseases if you haven't really talked about and made sure that your children are clear on the actual facts about what goes where and why. And then obviously, too, I think within all of this, we have to present our values. You know, I think it's probably a pretty standard value for most parents that either they want their children to wait until they're married, or at the very least, they want to make sure they're in a committed relationship.
Yeah.
It would be hard for me to believe that any parent wants their child to sleep around.
Yeah.
So that has to be presented as part of this as well.
Yeah.
Really specifically saying to your child, the reason to be in a committed relationship does have to do with sexually transmitted mm-hmm. diseases. It does have to do with the fact that when you have sex with someone, it changes your life and it changes their life
mm-hmm.
because it's the most intimate bond that two people can have with one another. And you have to be willing to take the risks. You have to be willing, you know, if you're having sex, you have to know that it will result in one of these three things. And these three points are actually from Deborah Rothman's book, Sex and Sensibility. But the three points are, when you have sex, you're going to either create a life, lose a life, or change a life.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready to do that?
Yeah.
You know, and starting these talks when children are probably not engaging in intercourse yet, but probably engaging or thinking about engaging in things like oral sex, because we're really seeing that at the sixth grade level. And
really?
And certainly throughout middle school years, you know, we really want to start talking about that, because diseases can be transmitted through oral sex as well.
Yeah.
And often children or tweens, both because of their egocentricity and the fact that they're misinformed, don't think of oral sex as sex. So another really important reason to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, when this kind of experimentation
yeah.
starts to begin.
I've had that talk with my kids too.
Good.
Because they don't think that oral sex is just not even as bad as kissing.
I know. I know. It's astonishing, right?
It is. It really is.
It's astonishing. And that's why we have to be so proactive as parents, because the misinformation, and it's probably information they're primarily getting from their peers, but the misinformation
yeah.
is just so prevalent.
Yeah.
And then with drugs, you know, it's the same thing. Make it factual. You know, start with simple. Do the building blocks. So you start talking about tobacco and alcohol. Then you talk about marijuana. Then you talk about the kind of, you know, recreational drugs that might be available in adolescence. We're not really talking about them necessarily engaging in this in the pre-adolescent years, but we have to lay the foundation. Although I would say that I think the latest research shows that the most common age at which kids begin to drink is 13.
Wow.
So when we start thinking about that, it's like, oh, my, you know, that's part of that pre-adolescent period, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's the tail end of it. And 13 often happens in middle school. So we have to be aware that our children could be exposed at least to that particular drug. And then, you know, again, we have to just, you know, very, very clearly lay down the facts. And I think, you know, clearly talk about what our expectations are for their behavior in our own homes
yeah.
and outside of our homes. You know, I expect you to not engage in illegal behaviors.
Yeah.
You're a minor until you're 18 for certain things and 21 for others.
Yeah.
And it's illegal to do this, you know, or to say, you know, depending upon what kind of a line you want to draw, or to say, you know, the reality is that if you're going to do this, I want you to do it responsibly, and here are the guidelines
yeah.
for this.
Well, that's a lot of fantastic advice, Julie.
Oh, thank you.
I really, you're a wealth of very, very practical, well-thought-of information. And I'm
thank
really
you.
Anxious for our viewers with tweens or children that are about to become tweens to listen to what you have to say, because this stuff is so, so good.
Oh, thanks.
And your book will be out soon.
It will be out in August.
And How to Hug a Porcupine is the name of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The author is Julie Ross. And I'd like to thank you, Julie, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.